entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Listening to Sam in the Morning with Jen, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to the show. Today's Thursday, May 28th, and we're back.
Yeah, we are.
Hi, Jen.
Hi.
We have two phone guests today calling in. We simply don't have enough time for everybody, so we had to squeeze in two today. But totally different things, but sounds pretty interesting. We're going to have one scientist who focuses on addiction therapy and things like that. And another lady who's going to call in who's got a book about living in a commune back in the 70s.
Yes, very different topics.
Yes. So that should be interesting. And just goes to show we give you everything in this show.
Yes, we do.
Not just one or two things, but we give you a variety here.
Yes.
So the plot thickens with my car with the whole light thing.
Oh, what happened now?
Yeah. So I did go back to the place and bitched and made the guy see that he lied to me, but he wouldn't admit anything.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So for those of you that don't know what I'm talking about, you should listen to yesterday's show. I was just trying to get a signal light fixed, and it became a whole thing, and it's still not fixed.
No.
Today I have to go to the dealer and hope that it'll be covered by warranty, because otherwise I'm in deep doo-doo. They have to replace the whole thing now.
Goodness.
Which is a few hundred dollars.
Goodness. Yeah. Hopefully it's under warranty.
Yeah, I hope that thing
you
is.
You just got the car, so.
No, the car's under warranty. I just don't know what they're going to say about the repair.
Right.
Since somebody's already gone in there and did something.
Got it.
Yeah. So I don't know what's going to happen there, but I'll probably spend a couple hours at the dealer today. So you can total up all the hours I spent just on fixing the signal light for Uber to pass the inspection. I killed 2 days already.
Well, hopefully it works out and that you make up for it in spades by driving for Uber.
Yes. Yes, I hope so. And, it's funny because there's an article about something that I was thinking about doing, and that is to rent out a car so you can drive for Uber if you don't have a good car or something.
Yeah. Well, so, how does that work with an inspection, though?
Yeah. Well, the inspection should work fine. I mean, you know, if the car is good. I don't understand this thing. There's a new company now that offers, it sort of like connects people that want to rent out their car,
yeah,
and people that want to drive them.
Like Airbnb, but for cars.
Exactly. So they're saying, you know, I mean, you can rent a car from like around $40 a day, which is pretty much what I estimated, $30-$40 a day. And they're saying that if you work 8 to 10 hours a day, you can make $200 that day. To me, that's a lot of work. Just for $200, but you know, I don't know. And that's after gas, they're saying. So,
yeah.
Gas and commission. So that's what you have left. That's not bad, actually. But it's good. I like it because it gives people an opportunity to earn some income, people that are unemployed.
Right. I think the like best that. Thing that you can do if you need money is use what you have. So whether it's your house, your car.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like things that you can sell even, like just. You know, you have so much around you that is probably, like, unused.
Yeah.
And you can use it for making money.
Yeah, that's true. Hmm. Okay, so we'll think about that, too. But I'm hoping this thing will get settled today so I can actually start driving and see what it's like.
Well, so, I wish you all the best with that.
Thank you.
It's been a long road.
Me and my adventures, right?
Right.
But I realized it's like I'll stop at nothing, man. When I want something, I'll stop at nothing.
That's
Nothing's
great.
Going to stop in my way, you know? And although some people's way of thinking is like, oh, well, maybe it's not meant to be. You know, you're having too many difficulties.
Yeah.
But I guess we'll find out, right?
Well, I mean, ultimately, you needed to get that light fixed anyway. So regardless of it being for Uber or not, maybe Uber is what led you to get it fixed.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much what happened.
Right.
So we'll see. Yeah. I mean, one mechanic asked me, you know, why do you, why would even the light go out on such a new car, you know? So there has to be something there.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like I had two repair shops that I went to, difference of night and day. You know, one place it's like they're lying, they don't want to take responsibility or anything. And then I went to the other place and they actually spent like half an hour on my car without charging me anything.
That's great.
Telling me I didn't need the repair or they couldn't do it. So yeah, and definitely use Yelp. You know, I think it helps. I didn't use it, but I sure gave them reviews.
Good.
To both places, a good and a bad one. And that's what you guys should do if you want to keep people on their toes. You know, and the funny thing is, the guy that I dealt with at the sucky place, he turned out to be the manager. So you're talking to the guy that lied to you.
Right.
And expected him to solve the problem.
He probably felt like invincible and that he could do whatever he wanted to do because he is the manager. So
yeah,
he's not going to get in trouble.
So then he calls the mechanic. The mechanic comes in here and he starts being confrontational with me.
The mechanic?
The mechanic.
Okay.
So I thought, what the hell, you know.
Well,
anyway, I don't like dealing with repair shops. And the nice thing is that I've driven new cars in recent years, so I haven't had to go to repair shops.
Yeah.
Because these people will rip you off every time because they know you don't know shit about cars, you know.
That is true.
Yeah. But you know what? I think in almost every service it's like that, you know. I've been known to complain about dentists that... they talk you into doing things maybe you need them, but you know, it's like every time you go to a dentist, you end up with like feeling guilty about your teeth. You know, at least me, I don't know what kind of dentist I go to. But you know,
I mean, they do usually say you could floss more, but other than that, I don't know what else they would make you feel guilty about.
Yeah, I don't know how much more I can floss. I mean, even when I go to sleep at 3:30 in the morning, I have to floss. I couldn't go to bed without it. You know?
Well, that's good.
I know. So, but yeah, they'll always find things wrong with you.
Oh, no. Sorry. Whoa. What was that?
That was cool. I know sometimes I put my phone in the case and it turns on the, it takes it off vibrate. So then it starts ringing.
Yeah.
And I never expect it to ring. You know?
Yeah. That's no, my phone never rings. That's why I was like, what is that sound? Yeah. Where is that coming from? Oh, it's me. Didn't know the phone even rang.
Yeah.
I usually keep it on silent because I hate noises that are like surprising.
Right. And not only that, but sometimes you're with people, you know.
Right.
I think it's rude.
I hate it.
Yeah. So that's why yours probably went off vibrate too. It's that button on the left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pulling it out of my purse.
Yeah. Something like that. Have you recovered from your trip yet?
I have.
Good. So you caught up on some sleep.
I think I have. Yeah. I mean, I feel better. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Yesterday, that was a long day.
A long one.
Yeah. So I think I just like.
Did you take that AfterBuzz yesterday that your mom posted? She posted a screenshot of your AfterBuzz with a show called Grace and Frankie.
No, that's on Tuesdays.
Oh, that's on Tuesday. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. What did she post now?
I don't know.
Mother, stop it.
No, she just says, she said something like, did you see Jen on the show or something?
Oh, you know? Yeah. We do that on Tuesdays.
Yeah. Okay.
Well,
it looked pretty cool.
Thanks.
So are you like the same four people every time?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's how it works at AfterBuzz. You have a panel.
Right.
And each panel addresses a particular show.
Right.
And then we do the whole season.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's a good show on Netflix. We really like it.
Really? From what I gathered, what is it, like a gay show or something? Are they gay, these guys?
Like, no. Sam.
Okay, it shows you I didn't really listen. You know, I just checked it out.
I mean, even just to call it a gay show. So it's a show about people in their, I believe, 60s and 70s.
Uh-huh.
And they're two separate couples. And they're like family friends for many years, like probably 20 years. And at some point during those years, the two men in each of the couples started a relationship together. And they realized they were gay and they've been in secrecy this whole time having a relationship.
So there is a gay thing going on there, right?
There's a gay relationship that is happening.
I wasn't like, completely wrong.
No, it's just how you said it.
Yeah, well, yeah.
A gay show.
Well, no, okay.
There's a show that addresses like, you know.
No, I meant like a show about gays. That's what
right. I understand. It just comes off a little offensive probably to other people.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend anybody.
It's fine. So, yeah, it's really interesting because of all the things coming out now about like Bruce Jenner and the show Transparent on Netflix, and like just dealing with these issues now more openly,
right,
and addressing, like, the characters address the fact that they hid it for 20 years because it wasn't acceptable, so they stayed in their marriages, right, with their heterosexual, you know, relationships and their families because that's what was supposed to be, right, and that wasn't accepted then. So now that they are free to come out because of the times and it's allowed and more acceptable, they're like, well, we're gonna be gay now, we're gonna be out, and we're gonna be together, and we're gonna get married.
Wow.
So then they address a lot of issues like, is it acceptable that they cheated just because they were gay? But what if they had cheated with other women? People,
right,
wouldn't have been so okay with it.
Exactly.
But because it was more of like a hardship, because it was something they would have been like persecuted against for, they are forgiven a little bit more.
Right.
So it's interesting to see the family dynamic and all of that.
Yeah. Sounds similar to Brokeback Mountain in a way, right?
I mean, no, weren't
they friends? No, I know, but I mean, weren't they friends also, and they had this secret thing?
Yes.
Okay, I never saw the movie, but so that's what I mean.
Sure. They were also cowboys. It was also a different time. So
I know.
When you say similar, very different.
All right. Sure, give me a hard time. You know, what can I say? I have associations in my head.
Yes, you do. But the show is really interesting. It's also about like reinventing yourself and starting over in, I think, your 60s or 70s, and facing like online dating and being single, and some things that you think about all the time about how, right, like, you're older than you once were, than other people are that you want to maybe hang out with. And it's funny. It's a great cast. Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, Martin Sheen, Sam Waterston.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's like a Netflix show?
It is a Netflix show.
Okay, that's what you guys
said. By Marta Kaufman.
Wow.
Who did Friends.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a good lineup, though.
Very good.
Wow.
Brooklyn Decker. It's a lot of people.
Yeah. Huh. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So it's not really you had to be forced to watch a show. You actually enjoy it.
Well, we choose which shows we're going to watch.
Oh, really?
That's how it works.
Oh, okay.
Because you want to talk about a show you would be a fan about.
Yeah, exactly. You want to be passionate about,
right, it. Exactly. So the premise is you're a super fan.
Right.
And then the people that are watching the show also clearly are super fans because they wouldn't be watching the after show for a show.
Right.
Then you've now spent an hour versus 30 minutes on one particular show. So they want us to be passionate about it, too. So we only pick shows that we want to talk about.
So those are like 30-minute episodes then?
Yeah.
Okay. I see, I can handle that. No problem.
Yeah.
So it's a comedy?
Yes.
Okay.
There are elements of drama, but it's like just because that's life.
Right.
But it's pretty funny.
Hmm. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll catch that. After I catch all the other shows that are really popular.
Yeah, tell me about it. I sat down last night to watch like a documentary because I'm like, I don't want to watch an entire series of TV right now and start one and at 9 o'clock and then stay up all night watching TV shows. But
right.
So I was like, I can watch one documentary and check that off my list. So I press play and then a girlfriend writes me, can you talk? And I'm like, well, she knows I'm awake, so I can't ignore her because we've been texting. And I don't want to be rude. And like, yes, I actually can talk. So I'm assuming it's like a 10-minute conversation. 40 minutes go by.
Oh, good.
Then it's like 10 o'clock and I'm like, shit, I'm not going to start a documentary at 10 o'clock because then I'll be up till 11:30 watching this thing and it's got subtitles and who really wants to pay attention to that right at this moment? Not me. So instead, I paused it and I'll just regroup it another time. But I was going to watch, I don't know how you say it, Hero Dreams of Sushi.
What's it about? Sushi?
It's about this guy, Hero, and he's in Tokyo, I think, and he is like the lead sushi person, sushi maker, and he like makes these like artisan sushi pieces.
Wow.
And it's about how when you love something, you have to work at it and you have to become obsessed with it. And he dreamt of it and it became his obsession and he wanted to be the best at it. So he became the best.
Yeah. That's the thing, man. If you have the drive, nothing will stand in your way, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
The drive, work ethic, and like a dream.
Yeah. You got to have the dream, right?
Yep.
You got to have something to work towards. But that's the thing is that you have to be passionate about it. You know, if you sit around and you go, gee, what can I start a business for? That's not the way to do it.
No, definitely not.
You have to
not.
Be something with like, I know I can make things better if I do it. And do it that way.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, it depends. You know, I think everybody's got both sides. Sometimes the side that will like give up and then the other side that'll go.
Well, I think that if somebody were to ever not feel like, oh, this is hard, then it probably wouldn't be worth doing.
Right. No, that's true. I mean, you want to be challenged. You know?
Right.
You want to feel that there's constant growth all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And be proud of yourself when you actually do accomplish it.
Exactly. And stay up till 4 in the morning like me.
Yeah.
Then people will believe you.
Yes. I don't know how you do it.
I know. I don't know, Jen. But
I went to sleep last night at maybe like 12:05. And I was like, oh, this is so late.
Wow.
Mind you, I can stay up to like all hours on the weekends. But
yeah,
like on a weeknight, knowing that I have to get up the next day and have an entire full day and be completely on the whole day.
Right. Yeah.
But I'm going to start meditating now. After the meeting last night, I realized it's going to be a thing for me.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you went to that TM, right?
Yeah, I went to the... It was like an intro session on Transcendental Meditation.
Uh-huh.
And while we thought maybe we'd go in there and they would try and like sell us something, it wasn't that at all. It was more just explaining what it is for the benefit of the people there to know what it is, because a lot of people don't. Right. A girlfriend I went with doesn't even know how to meditate or what it is. And so for her, it was like eye-opening. For me and Lauren, we were both like, wow, this is actually probably the kind of meditation we need.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool. So you're going to go how often? Like,
well, there's like an intro thing that you do where it teaches you the technique, because it is a technique. It's different than all the other kinds of meditation. I have to like save up for that. It's not that much. It's like $1,000, and then you get to go unlimited for the year or whatever it is to the actual location and do meditations with the group or private meditations and things like that. But I'm not ready to spend $1,000.
Yeah.
At some point, that's on my bucket list.
Yeah. Cool. Well, let's continue this conversation in a moment. And we're going to be joined right now by Dr. Adi Jaffe. Are you here with us?
I am.
Yes, thank you. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
That was actually very good, yeah.
Okay, cool. Dr. Jaffe, where are you calling us from this morning?
Why am I calling?
No. Where? I know why you're calling.
I'm calling from my office.
Okay.
In not yet sunny Los Angeles.
Oh, so you are in L.A. Cool, very cool.
Yeah.
So, you're involved. Are you a scientist? I mean, do you consider yourself a scientist?
Yeah, I have a PhD in psychology, so I'm a psychologist, a neuroscientist, addiction specialist.
Right, and yeah, so you focus on addiction and you do research on the topic and so forth. So tell us a little bit about how specifically you approach this, addiction and therapy and so forth.
Sure. So, you know, I run a center called Alternatives in addition to teaching at UCLA and doing research. And one of the things that I think makes the way I look at things pretty unique is, you know, there's the biggest argument in my field for many, many years now has been, is addiction a moral problem? Is it a disease? Is it just genetics? What's going on? And, you know, what I'm trying to sort of make people understand is that it's not really either or, it's a combination. What we end up finding are, yes, some people who struggle with addiction have it looking like a disease in a very kind of biological sense. You know, they use for a little while, then they become addicted, and they sort of cross over into this other threshold. But many other people that we see that are struggling with substances are having the exact same issues that everybody else in the world is having, whether they be anxiety, depression, social isolation, or whatever. And they found a medicine, if you want to call it that works for them. But that over time, that coping strategy has caused them issues, and that we need to move out of this world view where, you know, once an addict, always an addict, where what we do to people who struggle with these sort of things is we isolate them further by putting them in these, you know, separate groups that they must therefore be part of for the rest of their lives, and start believing all of a sudden somehow that they're going to be struggling and dysfunctional forever.
That's true. And then they label themselves as an addict all their lives. It makes sense what you're saying, you know? And so...
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, go on. Go on. So...
Yeah, I mean, I think we've worked in that sort of framework for a while. Look, if you look back, you know, 100, 150, 200 years, calling addiction a disease is better than calling people who are addicted, evil and and possessed and things of that nature. So that's nice. That was a nice move about 80 years ago, but I think it's time to move past that.
Yeah. Cool. So now, is this a method that you came up with, or are you developing this in a group? How does it work?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's something I came up with. Our clinical director and my partner here, Dr. Mark Kern, has been doing this sort of work in a private one-on-one setting for the better part of 30, 35 years. And there are a handful of other people, especially on the East Coast in New York, who are doing this sort of work, and then some standouts here on the West Coast as well. I think what we've done that's unique and alternative is we've structured that in some way. We've made it more official. We've made it more more palatable for people, and we've made it more accessible, I think, to people. So that my goal, you know, when I was doing research on addiction at UCLA, the thing that always bothered me is that 90% of people with this issue don't even go seek help. My goal at Opening Alternatives, my goal in all the work that I'm doing currently, is to flip that on its head and make it so that only 10, 15, 20% of people with this problem don't go look for help. This is one of the only problems, mental health issues in general, but addiction in particular, are one of the only sets of issues that we know of in the health field where people who know that they have an issue still don't go and seek help. And I think a lot of that has to do with the shame and the way we sort of treated them in society.
Yeah. And, you know, I think nobody wants to admit they have a problem either, you know. And addiction is a serious problem. And, you know, I think many addicted people are in denial, wouldn't you say?
Well, so, I mean, I think that's a really great point. But let me put it this way. You're right. People don't like admitting that they have issues, period. And so people don't like admitting that they have cancer. They don't like admitting that they have diabetes. They don't like admitting that they have hypertension. But even in those sorts of conditions, you know, still chronic, long-term, life-threatening kinds of conditions, when somebody is told that they have the condition, typically we see rates between 60 and 80% of acting on that, so going and getting some help or treatment for it.
Right.
My personal belief is that the reason we don't see that with addiction is because we use terms like, you know, people are in denial, or because, you know, they're not ready to admit it. My experience working with a lot of these people, and by the way, my own personal experience, is that that's not exactly true. But what we end up doing in our industry, in the addiction treatment industry, is that we only offer one solution, and that solution is not very palatable. Imagine for a second if when somebody went to complain about having foot pain to their doctor, they would get immediately scheduled for an amputation the next day, because the only way to treat foot pain is by getting rid of the foot.
Yeah.
Or imagine if you went to your diabetes specialist or your general practitioner, if they're good enough at managing that, and they said, well, you're diabetic, so you need insulin, dietary change, and some more exercise. And you said, well, I'm not really sure about the dietary change, and your doctor would throw you out of treatment for not fully complying.
Wow.
As bizarre as those notions seem, that's what we've done to people in this field. And I think that once we start moving back from that a little bit, we'll see that a lot less people are in denial. They just want a different kind of help, and the sort of help that we maybe haven't been able to offer for a while now.
Right. Like something more, with more empathy, let's say, somebody who understands them more. Because I know, you know, people can go to 12-step meetings and stuff, and I've heard that, you know, it can actually alienate you from what you're trying to do. Would you say that?
And I think you hit the nail right on the head. So imagine if somebody says, well, I know I have a problem with this drug or with alcohol. I want to get some help for that, but I'm not quite ready to give it up. Up to now, we would say, well, they're in denial and they're not ready for help. What I say is they're ready for help. They're just not ready to quit. Let's just get them some help and see where it goes from there. Meetings, AA meetings, by the way, are very effective for some people and very ineffective for others. I think we need to stop pretending like the people for whom they're ineffective are somehow flawed. And just, again, just like with any other treatment that we would consider, say, okay, well, this treatment didn't work for you. Let's try this other treatment. And so we actually offer a variety of different approaches for people depending on what they're ready to do at any given point in time.
Right. Sounds very promising. So how can people take advantage of this program?
Well, you can reach us through addictionalternatives.com. Okay. That's probably the easiest way. Our phone number is 888-532-9137. And you can look up for my name, Dr. Jaffe, D. Jaffe online, or Dr. Mark Kern, and we're pretty easy to find.
Now, is this something that's very expensive? Because I know that like rehab facilities can, you know, obviously range in price, and some are accessible to people and some aren't. Is yours accessible to the everyman?
So first of all, we're outpatient, which makes it already a lot more accessible for a few reasons. You go to residential treatment, you have to leave life behind for 1 to 3 months. Most people can't leave their job, leave their family for 1 to 3 months. So first of all, you can keep working while being with us. That's already useful. Secondly, outpatient treatment is much, much cheaper. This isn't a joke, but I tell a lot of our clients that for less than what one of those typical really expensive treatment costs for 1 month, you can be with us for more than 6 months.
Wow.
So much, much more affordable.
Yeah. Well, it sounds pretty...
And we take insurance.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, this sounds like a fresh new view on this thing. And, you know, because you keep hearing the same things all the time. You know, I'm an addict, I'm an alcoholic, and all that. And people define themselves by their addiction, you know, which I think is not productive at all. It's not conducive to...
I completely agree. I think, you know, I'm in this field to help people. And my hope is that we can do more and more and more of that. I'm actually giving a TED Talk at UCLA this upcoming weekend specifically on how can we eliminate more shame and make it so that people are more likely to go seek help.
Right. And, you know, it's amazing because you approach it from a scientific point of view, yet you're being empathetic of how people feel and how they go about this. It's not just a calculated, cold, you know, thing that you do.
Yeah. No, I fully agree. I think I got into this field. I know everybody I work with got into this field to help people. I don't think it's necessarily helpful to be dogmatic and to, you know, sort of believe in a one-size-fits-all, all-or-nothing kind of approach to this.
Right. Well, that sounds great. So give us the website again so people can check it out
more. It's addictionalternatives.com, one word.
Okay.
And again, Adi Jaffe is my name. Mark Kern with a C, M-A-R-C. Kern is my partner's name. And we are we're relatively easy to find online, and I welcome any inquiries.
Sounds great. And you guys are located at UCLA?
We are close to UCLA. Our facility is close to UCLA. I teach at UCLA.
I see. Okay. Great. And how long have you been in the field now?
So I've been doing research in addiction for over 10 years, about 12 years. Mm-hmm. I've been on the treatment side for about 5.
I see. Wow. So you've been around for a while doing this, which is tremendous to me. So, and you mentioned you had a personal experience also that moved you towards this?
I did, yeah. I mean, I'm an ex-meth addict myself.
Wow.
I was for about 3 to 5 years, I was struggling pretty heavily with stimulants, methamphetamine in particular. And I left that world or left that life in 2002 and have been on this side for a while now. I'm not fully sober, which is a shocking fact for a lot of people out there. I still drink, and I drink responsibly and don't have a problem with it. I'm very passionate about helping people.
Awesome. Dr. Adi Jaffe, thank you so much for joining us. And everybody,
thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Everybody go to addictionalternatives.com. You'll find out more about this, and it sounds promising. And it sounds to me like you guys are focused on the person, which I think is very important, you know, not on labeling them, but actually helping them out. So that's
we do our best. Thank you so much for having us on.
Of course. Thank you for calling in, and all the best to you.
All right. Same to you. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, I see our other guest is calling, so we better switch gears right away and go ahead and take that. Good morning. You're on the air. Margaret?
Yes.
Yes. Margaret, how do you pronounce your last name?
Grunstein.
Grunstein, okay. It's always better to ask than to butcher the name, you know?
I'm used to it. But thanks for asking.
Great. And where are you calling us from this morning?
Los Angeles.
Oh, so you're here too?
Yes, I am.
Wow, everybody's here.
It often feels like that.
Yeah. So where did you grow up?
You know, I'm from the Midwest. I'm a Motown girl, raised in Detroit, moved to the East Coast, went to the school for a while on the East Coast, and then headed west, and then to Oregon, and then south to San Francisco, and ultimately here to Los Angeles for about, I don't know, 38 years.
Wow. So you moved quite a bit earlier in your life.
Well, I was stable, you know, then in my younger years, moved around and then settled here. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. So now tell us what it is that you do. I see you're a photographer, a psychotherapist, and you also have a preschool out here in Venice.
You know, I never would have anticipated my life went the way it did. I don't know what I quite expected. I studied urban planning. I thought I would be a professional somewhere on the East Coast. The book I wrote was about, you know, dropping out and living in the woods for 5 years. But then after that, and I came back in around 1975 and had to claw my way back into the middle class, I fell into early childhood education. And I have a lovely, dear little preschool. I've had it for about 36, 37 years in Venice, California. And then I went back. I wanted to know how to deal more complex issues, and I got a MFT, so I have a private practice as a therapist, out of which office I am presently speaking right now.
Yeah, well, very cool. So you're a very ambitious woman. You do a lot of different things, which is cool.
Yeah.
But let's talk about your book. Your book, was it just published?
Yes. Its official date is, you know, I think June 1st. The unofficial, I had my launch party about a week ago.
Oh, nice. Actually, it says June 10th, I guess. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, June 10th. Well, very cool. So you had a launch party, too?
Yes.
Oh, wow, very cool. So the book is called Naked in the Woods, My Unexpected Years in a Hippie Commune. And, you know, that really grabbed me because I think this happened a lot in the 70s, didn't it? Where people were...
Yes and no. I mean, everybody, there was huge changes and many people's lives were affected. But we actually walked away and disappeared and left the trajectory. Many people were weekend hippies or did it in addition to work. But there were a significant number of people that started intentional communities or unintentional communities, whatever you want to call it.
Uh-huh. Wow. So now, how did you... So at the time when, like just before you joined the commune, what were you doing at the time?
I was a graduate student at Yale in city planning, and I met my first husband there, who was a dynamic, charismatic man, and into community organizing, and the times in the architecture school, it was student revolution at that time, and taking over the schools and fighting for, you know, racial integration, equal rights, peace, not war, all sorts of things. And we all decided, instead of doing traditional, well, other people were architects, but we decided to live the life we wanted to live instead of trying to change everybody else's life.
Right.
And the politics got confrontational and aggressive, and it just seemed like a more benign way of living would be a better way to make change.
Right. So was it your husband that actually introduced you to this kind of lifestyle or to the idea of actually joining a commune like that?
Well, you know, we didn't. The commune didn't exist. We headed west in bits and pieces and kind of gathered, and it kind of happened accidentally. And it became a cluster of many friends from graduate school, and many of them were connected down at University of Houston as well. And we first landed in Eugene. We headed west without a plan, landed in Eugene, rented a farm for a year, and then moved on to 160 acres that had nothing, no running water, no electricity, no phones, nothing. And you get to know each other.
Yeah. I'm sure.
That's true. I remember back in the 70s, 80s, they had, do you remember that Rajneesh Bhagwan, whatever his name was. And then,
there were a lot of religiously organized ones, yeah.
Yeah. Was that in Oregon as well? Do you remember?
There might have been one in Oregon. You know, right. There were so many different kinds. There were ones with gurus, ones very structured. We were all artists and architects, mostly, not me. No one, you know, having a leader following somebody else, right. You know, having dogma. We were much more loosely wrapped,
yeah.
Shall we say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were hippies, real hippies.
Yeah, and part of the reason I wanted to write the book was to not just make it such a silly, people say it and they see something two-dimensional that seems kind of silly, but our hearts were really in it, and it's more complex to live together in peace and harmony than one would think.
Yeah, I can imagine. How many people were there in the commune?
You know, we were small. There was a cluster of maybe a core of us of 10. By the time we moved on to the sort of the undeveloped land that had nothing on it at all, by the time winter came there, the single women left, and it was man's country. And then in the summer, frequently we'd have a lot more guests, but we were always small, but we were part of a collection of other small kind of underground groups that lived around.
Right. So how come the single women left? What happened?
Well, it's what I faced when my husband left and I was there. You know, I'm living in a tent. The winter's coming. It's going to be rainy and cold. Before you can even make dinner, you have to chop down a tree.
Yeah.
You know, what are you going to live in? You have to deconstruct some other falling down cabin because there's no money. Everything is dependent on, you know, you have to pump the water, light the fire. You know, we went back in technology, you know, 150
years. Yeah.
So just to chop everything, take care of a truck or a vehicle, we were isolated. We were pretty way off the grid, to use the present-day term.
Wow.
So we went from a trajectory of great projected success, you know, in America's cities to, you know, hauling water.
Right. Well, that's very curious because obviously most people would not take a step like this. You know, we're all pretty much in the rat race and everything. And you know, and I think people are afraid. I mean, sometimes it sounds so great just to live in isolation away from all the hustle and bustle of the city and, you know, all the career and the hard work that we put in every day. Sometimes it feels like life is just a labor camp out here, you know. And that's all we do is work, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So there you pretty much you had to survive from the land. Off the
well,
land.
Yes. I mean, I can't say we lived off the land.
Yeah.
You know, that we, you know, there were times we got food stamps, which certainly felt uncomfortable to me.
Yeah.
When we were getting surplus food and peanut butter and cheese, it felt okay. But food stamps really felt, I'm from the group that gives out money, not from the group that receives it. And I felt the trickery behind it didn't sit well. We did have a garden. I loved gardening. We had to learn how to kill our own animals, which was very hard.
Yeah.
And we didn't always do it. And we also culled some dumpsters behind grocery stores because there's wonderful bounty back there.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I mean, so there, you know, but at, there were wonderful transcendent moments of feeling part of something bigger than myself, feeling part of a group,
right.
Feeling truly part of a community and trying to build something that I felt was bigger than just ordinary life. And life has a way of following us wherever we go, though. It can be complex and full of flaws wherever we go.
Yeah. And I would imagine, though, at the time, it probably wasn't that strange, right? I mean, in the 70s, you guys were not the only ones who lived a different kind of lifestyle.
No. I mean, all sorts of things were strange at that time. I'd run across some things when I was in the graduate school where the students took over the school and we did in admissions, and I found a photocopy of a letter I wrote to a man for our ad hoc admissions committee of the city planning department admitting him, and then the president of Yale writes another letter saying, no, you aren't admitted. And I thought, how did we have the hubris to do that? You know, things were topsy-turvy.
Yeah.
You know, students were being shot. You know, everything was upside down. But it was strange to go that as far as we did. Not strange, it was a little bit more extreme. Not everybody threw away their, you know, 5 years of their professional lives or their, you know, their direction. But it certainly was a different time than today and easier to do today than today.
Right. That's right. Because I think at the time we weren't that dependent on technology.
No.
Yet, right?
Well, cell phones didn't exist, and we had no phones. You know, I have two daughters who live in Portland, and it's kind of the Berkeley of this generation. And many of the things that my generation was putting forth, they live in their daily life there with all the political righteousness and the ups and the downs of that. But it's integrated into a more daily life. You know, at that time, you know, there we weren't, when I dropped out, that we didn't have the computers, we didn't have the phones, and we had no electricity there, and we were probably, you know, now it would be a different experience because there probably would be some way to Wi-Fi in.
Right. Wow. Very interesting. So the book is Naked in the Woods. We're talking to Margaret Grandstein. And so you're also a photographer. Tell us a little bit about that. How did you get into that?
Well, I sort of fell into it. My dad, when I was growing up, I always remember my dad down in the basement in our house of Detroit developing pictures he took of us, black and white pictures. And it was magic to me to see them come. And he gave me a camera when I was, I don't know, somewhere in my early 20s, late teens. And I started using it. But once I was in Oregon, I really wanted to develop my skill. And I had something that meant so much to me and that I knew was full of humor and meaning to me. So I wanted to photograph it. And the shock to me is that today, pictures I took, you know, 40 years ago, I'm using. I never would have thought that.
Wow. Very cool. So, you know, I mean, like we said before, you do a lot of different things, and that's very cool, leading a full life. The book is coming out June 10th, and it's called Naked in the Woods, My Unexpected Years in a Hippie Commune, and it sounds very cool. You know, we got a copy of the book, so, you know, I skimmed over it a little bit, and it sounds very interesting. You know, I mean, I think it's different. I don't think there's been a lot of books written on the topic to sort of like let us in on what kind of life you guys had.
I think you hit on something important there, because I really wanted this to be, to experience it with all the subtleties and all the joys and the complexities. And I wrote it in a narrative, it's almost like it's a novel, so that it's hopefully not a dry read, but an interesting and compelling read that you care about. You know, you want to turn the pages to find out what happens. But I think you hit, yes. And I think that era is coming back as my generation writes our memoirs and you know, writes down what we experienced. But I'm thrilled to be able to share it. And glad about your interest.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, Margaret, thank you so much. It sounds very exciting, and I'm sure you're nervous and excited at the same time and exhilarating that the book came out. How long did it take you to put it together?
Well, I had to learn to write because I've never written before.
Uh-huh.
So it took me, I don't know, about 4 or 5 years from conception to the finished book, and then I had to get it out to publisher and then work through the publisher. So from the first glimmering of an idea to actually hitting the stands, it's probably about 8 years.
Yeah, and that's good. I mean, that's a lot of, I think, discipline. I don't think I could do something for 4 years, 5 years, and hope I would ever be finished with it, you know?
But, well, every day passes, and you never know where it's going to take you. And it was an adventure and a thrill and exciting for me.
Very cool. And do you have a website also where people can find out more about you?
Yes, it's my name, MargaretGrunstein.com, GRUNDSTEIN. So MargaretGrunstein.com, and everything should be on that.
Sounds good. And if someone lives in L.A., they can come to your preschool. Do you want to give out the name of it?
I like to keep that quiet.
Okay.
You know? I mean, I appreciate the opportunity.
But that's okay. You don't need,
Any
more promotion.
Of that, so it's available there.
Yeah. No, very good. Yeah. I think it's a smart thing to do. Well, so if you guys want to send your kids to the preschool, just kind of guess where she is. All right, Margaret. Well, thank you so much for calling in. The book is Naked in the Woods. Go out and get this. Sounds interesting. And much success with it. We wish you all the best.
Thank you. And thanks for this opportunity.
Of course. Bye-bye, Margaret.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. A lot of interesting stories, you know. I mean, that's why I love having guests on the show, you know. You learn so much about people.
Yep.
And that's what the world is about, people.
I agree.
Yeah.
I find them fascinating.
Yeah. I know. It's like all of our life is surrounded around people, you know, and I guess that's a good thing. Yesterday, I was driving, I was stopped at the stoplight. A little dog starts walking in the middle of the road. And I thought,
all by itself?
My God, yeah. Nobody even around him. And I wanted to go out and get him, but I thought, you know, I don't want to leave the car in the middle of the street here. I was in a hurry. And also, he looked like he was walking away. And I thought, well, if I just go out there and he's going to run away or something, you know?
Yeah.
And then run into the street, and then I'd feel really bad.
Yeah.
So I just left it for someone else. But he looked lost and thirsty and hot, and I felt so bad for him, you know? And I'm not that much, I mean, I love animals, but not to the point where, you know, I make them part of my family or something like many people do.
Yes.
But I still have a lot of compassion for them, and especially for dogs that seem so helpless, you know.
Yeah.
And you just want to help them out.
I want to save all the animals.
I know. Well, that's what you should get into.
No, I can't do that.
A side thing, you know.
I have so many side things. I actually just thought about starting my blog again, and now I'm like, oh, now I've got to do that.
Yeah.
But it's fine. I feel like that would be great
to
do that again. So one side thing at a time. Plus, I have a lot of years left.
Exactly.
So there's many years to do a million different side things.
That's true.
The long list.
It
obviously,
is a very
I have a list.
Long list. Yeah.
Like at some point, I'm going to be a life coach, and at some point, I'm going to have a dog rescue or an animal rescue, and then at some point,
well,
I'm going to travel
you have
a lot.
Some dreams and plans and stuff.
Of course.
You know. Yeah, traveling is cool. I think travel really is the ultimate goal for everyone, you know. Think about it.
Well, there are some people that don't like traveling, which never understand. But.
That's true. So not for everyone, but when people think of like retirement and everything or like the goals in life, I think that's what it is. I want to travel.
Right.
You know, and so it's nice to be able to see other cultures and everything. I've been in many places around the world, and I'm grateful that I have, you know, and but I love America. I always love coming back here, man. There's nothing like it.
It is nice knowing this is home.
Yeah. You want to kiss the ground when you arrive here. At least I do. Even though they're not very nice to you at the immigration and the customs and stuff. But who cares? I don't blame them. They see millions of people every day irritating people.
Their job is a thankless one.
It is.
They have to deal with a lot of personalities and a lot of issues.
I know.
And then it's their responsibility, too.
I know. And then we wonder why they don't smile or anything.
Right.
You know? Don't have a good attitude about it.
No. Yeah.
Well, the jobs that people take, man.
Hey, someone's got to do it.
Yeah, exactly. And finally, before we go, did you hear that there's a text that you can receive on your iPhone which will crash it?
What?
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's a weird message. They're saying that it's nonsensical, includes two English words, a string of Arabic characters that appears to have no meaning, and a Japanese character. And apparently what it does is, I guess Apple has acknowledged this and saw this, but what it does essentially is it crashes your phone and turns it off automatically. So.
And then how does it get fixed?
Well, then it restarts, I guess. It doesn't really kill the phone. It just crashes it so it freezes.
And what's the point of that?
Probably to sabotage people, you know.
No, but like, does it steal your information?
No,
like,
no, it doesn't do any of this stuff.
How do you get that text? Where does it come from? I've got questions.
Yeah. They're saying there's an error in the iPhone, you know, the way it displays incoming messages. So it's probably just not, you know, people probably do it for fun than anything else. You know, but, it's kind of a, you know, small thing. I don't know if you'll ever get one of those, but if you do, you'll know what I'm saying. And the thing is, they're saying you don't even have to open the text. You just receive it, and the phone immediately crashes.
Yikes. Well, good thing mine backs up.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you got to back it up, man.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it for today. Tomorrow, I think we also have a phone guest, right? Yeah, we do. So, an easy week, an easy short week.
Yep. Friday.
Friday. All right, everybody. Thank you all for joining us. Thanks our guests for today, Dr. Adi Jaffe and Margaret Grunstein. Great show. And we'll see you tomorrow.
Yep.
listening to Sam in the Morning with Jen, right here on LA Talk Radio.